You're listening to Pastola Endocrine Podcast.
Welcome to Pastola Podcast. We're honored to have Dr. Stephen Wackusbeck from MD Anderson here with us, professor of medicine and pediatrics at Baylor School of Medicine, or MD Anderson Cancer Center. That's right. And a world expert, really, in thyroid cancer and all kinds of endocrine neoplasias. So we're glad you're here with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a great meeting.
It's a great and wonderful talk that you gave yesterday. Did you want to hit on some of the salient points again and to get us going?
Yeah, happy to. Well, was asked to speak about pheochromocytoma and paragangliomas in children. And so basically throughout the talk, we reviewed, you know, kind of clinical presentation and how to manage these children. But most of the talk was focused on the genetics because, you know, these tumors are 80% of them are linked to a hereditary tumor syndrome. So the salient points were to always think of VHL and familial paraganglioma syndromes in children presenting with these tumors. Of course, we also see them in MEN2, but it's not the most common that a lot of us tend to think of right away. And so, you know, we reviewed that. We talked about the different biochemical phenotypes, how children tend to have more norepinephrine and norepinephrine secretion. And we wrapped up with some diagnostic, you know, talking about scans and theranostics. And I presented some of the, at least the one only approved radiopharmaceutical drug to treat metastatic tumors. And as well as we discussed some newer drugs that are being developed to treat these very rare cases where the tumor has spread.
Great. It seems like, you know, more and more genetics is driving a lot of the medical care. And also there's a lot of individualized or personalized medicine with the genes kind of driving the care in a very specific direction. So for a pediatric endocrinologist that's out in the community or at a medical center that doesn't have the same resources as an endocrine neoplasia center at MD Anderson, what's your suggestion as to how to proceed with a patient that they might suspect might have an endocrine neoplasia? I'm sure there's more genetic testings and panels available. And then, you know, do you have any suggestions on how to proceed from there?
Yeah, so, you know, most children who present with like a, what I call a neuroendocrine tumor, so, you know, differentiated thyroid cancer aside, most other tumors, you have to think genetics because they're more likely to be linked to other hereditary syndromes, you know, MEN1 or of course the PPGL syndromes that we talked about. So, you know, at least where I'm at, we know we work directly with a genetic counselor who does the counseling, who helps arrange the genetic testing, and then most importantly helps with disclosing results, because one thing we've learned through various sessions at this meeting is that, you know, you can sometimes get these variants of uncertain clinical significance and how to interpret that and how to share that information with the family. So my recommendation for someone who's like not at an academic center, it's to, you know, there are a couple of things you can do. One is to refer specifically to your local genetics program or, you know, whatever center is close to, you know, investigate that further. And then the National Society for Genetic Counselors also has a website that, you know, you can also just search for, you know, programs or counselors that are close to you. And that would be another option. I know some clinicians order genetic testing themselves. So that's usually discouraged to some degree, partly because you might have to fight the insurance battles to justify it. And then again, the importance of the disclosure part and counseling the family. Okay, now you have this mutation. What does it mean for the other family members? Yeah.
Yeah, that brings up an important point. You know, when we do genetics ourselves, there's a lot of variants of unknown significance, but also when there's a known mutation, more and more companies are offering free testing, whether it's for obesity or we just heard about free testing for skeletal dysplasias. Once we discover something, there could be a lot of implications. Like you said, there is the SHD beta, for example. Yeah. SDHB. Yes. Get the right lingo here. SDHB. We have the possibility of looking for other things later. Or many of these have the possibility of needing to look for other tumors at different times in your life. So proper genetic counseling and such can't be stressed enough, right? I mean, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's also probably a medical legal aspect to this as well. I would say, have you run into, you know, some of those things where if you find out on a panel that you have something, what kind of disclosures or anything else that do you want to speak to that at all or not?
No, fortunately, it's made a lot easier because we work directly with the genetic counselors. But there have been, you know, very classic cases of, you know, a failure to disclose. So one of the things that say, I'm seeing your child and we identify a mutation or we're seeing you and we identify a mutation. Then the question is, you know, how do you disclose that to other at-risk family members? So part of the counseling is that, you know, other family, particularly if it's related to a cancer, right, or something that you can do something about, is how do you disclose that to other family members who are at risk? And you at least need to inform them that they may be at risk for having this genetic condition. So there were some classic cases with MEN2, or a classic case where there was a lawsuit of a failure to disclose to other family members that they could have this condition. But fortunately, we don't deal with that much now. But one thing that I've seen parents worry about, it's insurance discrimination. And of course, there are laws in place that protect medical insurance, at least, that there you should not be discriminated against from a medical insurance standpoint based on having a genetic disorder. But of course, you know, children or patients who have a genetic disorder can't really get life insurance or disability insurance. So these are things that like a genetic counselor reminds us about and talks to the parents about so that they fully understand all the implications of having a genetic test. Because it's not, there's before doing the test, right? And that's what I tell my patients too, as it's like, okay, you're not going to be discriminated or your child's not going to be discriminated for insurance. But, you know, if they want life insurance someday, maybe you think about getting a policy now on them that they could take over versus. So it's these kind of things that we forget about. For us, we just want to order the test and get the result. But it's a little bit more complicated. Yeah.
And I would say that, you know, in some of the talks yesterday and today, there was some of that where there's, you know, some testing center that's available and we want to do what's best for our patient and try to get to the bottom of things. But there could be a lot of things to think about before the testing, right? So the genetic counseling before and some of those things that we don't really think about. So where do you see pediatric endocrinology and specifically some of the endocrine neoplasias and stuff 10, 15 years from now? And, you know, how do you see this developing?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I think it's going to get a little bit more murky. You know, as I mentioned yesterday in the talk that, you know, recommendations. So, you know, one of the things we do as pediatric endocrinologists is we have a child who is identified to have a genetic condition that has not yet manifested any disease, right? And so we have to screen, we have to come up with some monitoring strategy. And the current recommendations are flawed based on, you know, just being decided, like an age of screening is based more on earliest age of onset reported in the literature, not necessarily a critical review of the age distribution and what is the Gaussian distribution and what's plus or minus two and, you know, doing it that way like we would for any lab test. So I think that's going to be an ongoing challenge is like really determining the best methods of screening. At what age do you start? And right now, I think for a lot of conditions, we're maybe a little too aggressive and start a little younger than we have to. Of course, you never want to miss that one child, but there's also consequences to overscreening and, you know, financially, psychologically, to our patients. And, you know, it's a worry to me too. And you see this probably in Oklahoma is that, you know, our patients, we can see for a while and then they age out of patient parents insurance or they're on Medicaid and then they lose Medicaid, you know, once they turn 19. And then, so you can do all this screening in childhood, but then they're left as young adults without any clear screening program, or, you know, to, because they just can't pay for it. So I think that's a challenge. And another one, and you probably see this a lot more than I do because you work at an academic center, but, you know, since more like whole exome sequencing is being done on kids who just have various problems, you're finding more of these mutations in these hereditary endocrine tumor syndromes. And you're like, and there's no family history. And it's like, so what do I do with this 2-year-old who now has, you know, so we've seen like, you know, minor RET mutations or SDHA mutations that just, you know, accidentally get picked up on these panels. So I think that's going to be another challenge for pediatric endocrinologists, is you're going to be seeing these patients who have these mutations identified, and you're going to be asked to, well, what do you do with this?
So I think one of the big take home points I got from your talk as a clinician, that was also the lower limit of age, even though it says that in the textbook or in the literature, is just the first patient that was identified with that problem. And I've kind of run into that with some families as well, where, you know, the RET mutation, for example, if it's not the one that needs to come out immediately, and the family history has been more like, you know, the grandpa got medullary not till later in life, and the mom didn't have it till later, they're hesitant to do the thyroid removal before, just based on those criteria, because, you know, they're just using their family as a marker. But then I'm also caught in that cycle where, you know, if there is going to be something that would be terrible for that child, you know, so they're past the bottom age, but the families are trying to hold on, and we just document that, you know, we've asked it to be done. But you know, do you have any suggestions on anything of that sort? Or
I mean that's a struggle. I one of the first things I learned about specifically MEN2, which is what we're talking about, is that you can't really depend on the family history, because the disease doesn't always look the same. Yeah. And, you know, I remember when I first started at MD Anderson, we had this very large kindred from Qatar who came in, and the proband was a 20-something-year-old man with widely metastatic medullary cancer. And he wound up dying of his medullary cancer. And so we gradually, you know, tested the whole family. But he had cousins the same age who had microscopic MTCs, you know, at the age of 30. So, you know, it's very variable. So that's one thing I learned early. And so, yeah, sometimes family members do look at their, you know, our parents look at their family members, right? And, but that's not always the thing. So yeah, it's, you know, and I look at 634. So that's the classic MEN2A mutation. So right now, the current recommendation is to remove the thyroid by age 5. And then you'll see case reports of like, oh, here's a 2-year-old who had MTC. Therefore, we need to reconsider the age at which we do this surgery. But in reality, 634 mutations are rarely metastatic by the age of 10. So even though you could get an MTC very early, it doesn't necessarily mean it will metastasize. And really, at the end of the day, we just want to prevent metastatic MTC, not necessarily prevent the MTC itself. So that's like a hard concept to kind of wrap our minds around. But that's a good example. So, you know, someday there may be a 634 patient who's 1, you know, so it's to drop the age to everyone. Exactly. Yeah. Right. I think we appreciate it, but, you know, we published a paper years ago looking at TSH levels in children with MEN2 after thyroidectomy. And the majority of them do not have controlled TSH levels, even in the most ideal family situations. And it's just because, you know, they're growing so much at that age, it's sometimes hard to keep up. So yeah, we can't underestimate that the downsides of it as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Wagishbeck, for this great conversation. Did you have any final words of wisdom for us, or it was great having you here? Yeah, the talk was very wonderful. I would say that if you haven't had a chance to look at Dr. Wagishbeck's talk from yesterday, please go visit that virtually. It'll be available for a couple of weeks coming up, and it's very informative and well presented. Thank you. Thanks.